Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And this week, President Obama has done a number of things that one associates with a president. He's participated in the Easter egg roll. He's thrown out the first pitch at a Nationals baseball game. And he's signed a nuclear arms reduction treaty with Russians.
And of those three, which do you think is the most important? I would say the...
Well, I think it's a close race in some respects. Although, while all three are important symbolic, if you will, emblems of the presidency, there is a chance that signing this nuclear arms reduction with the Russians will mean a new direction for our relationship with the Russians and more significant agreement limiting more than just strategic nuclear weapons and doing more to really reduce the threat of nuclear war will follow.
So you're not really the least bit concerned that Obama's first pitch Monday at Nationals Park was high and outside? And
outside, depending on whether you're talking about a right-handed or a left-handed batter. It could have been a beanball if there had been a left-handed hitter.
Well, in other words, there's no way that Obama makes the starting rotation, although actually... Have you seen the starting rotation?
I have seen the first couple.
Okay, he's a third starter.
So not a great-looking pitch, but much better-looking pants. You remember last year when the president threw out a first pitch, he wore some baggy dungarees, which were widely described and derided as mom jeans.
I did not know that, but I did notice that out of his pocket, he pulled out a Chicago White Sox cap, which shows, once again, with a Nationals jacket, a White Sox cap, he's triangulating again.
I think he is. Boy, yes. He's got American League. Right. He's got National League.
Right. He also has Bart Stupak and progressives. And actually, there's a rumor going around that Bart Stupak may not ultimately run for re-election.
Now, Bart Stupak is under siege, of course, by the Tea Party, which has...
Well, left and right.
That's correct. He has an opponent in the Democratic primary who opposes him from the left. And then he also has a number of candidates. What's the number at this particular time?
I think three.
All right. Republicans who are running against him and competing for the chance to get the nomination against him. And he's, of course, become a national figure in a way that he's never been before by being an important vote for the health care bill in the end and bringing over with him a number of other anti-abortion Democrats who had been critical to the Democratic majority to pass the ultimate bill.
And, you know, it's funny, while the Democrats are fighting over progressives versus conservatives and blue dogs versus the abortion pro-choice, and the Republicans have no problems at all.
No, the Republicans are one big, united, happy family in a way that I have rarely seen them before. They are completely agreed about that pitch that you mentioned. They all thought that it was wild and off to the left.
They did, and they also think that their chairman is not so wild and is doing a good job. Well, actually, publicly, that's what the line had been from Republican National Committee members for the longest time, because for all the talk about dumping Michael Steele.
Michael Steele, that was the name. I was having a hard time coming up with
Michael Steele.
Because he never gets any kind of media exposure.
No. There are more and more calls for his resignation. Alex Castellanos, who has become a CNN talking head, but he's also somebody who works with a lot of candidates, and he seems to be among a rising number of folks who seem to say that Michael Steele's effectiveness, if not tenure, is finished at the Republican National Committee.
Well, this represents a bit of a tipping point, because there had long been a consensus that even though there was a lot of controversy about some of the things that Michael Steele has said and controversy about how much money was being spent, some of it in lavish ways, that it was better to let him serve out his 2-year term and replace him after the midterm elections, roughly 10 months from now. And that would just make sense as a way to minimize attention paid to the controversy surrounding him. But largely because of the Voyeur Club, and we've talked about this already, and some of the subsequent sort of slow bleeding from that story where you have his chief of staff leaving, where you have his communications director leaving, some prominent donors, people who really matter to the Republican Party, like Sam Fox, pulling out, some people from the social right, like Tony Perkins, saying they don't want social conservatives to give money directly to the RNC
anymore. And other groups forming to raise money on independently raising money on behalf of Republican candidates, independent of the RNC.
Which, of course, is also a trend that's going on more generally. It's not only about Michael Steele.
Right.
It's affecting the Democrats as well. It's easier for independent expenditures, that is, groups that make independent expenditures, to raise money and to spend money and to have effect on individual campaigns. They can be quicker, and they're like the corsairs darting amidst the Spanish galleons of the old-fashioned conventional parties.
But I'm just wondering how much this translates into problems for the Republican Party in November. I suspect it may not. The money issue may become a problem, but ultimately when you talk to state chairmen around the country, Michelle Norris spoke to Dick Wadhams of Colorado this week and All Things Considered, and he said, look, you know, I mean, there's some things that Michael Steele says that are embarrassing, but it doesn't affect us trying to win the Senate seat and the governorship of Colorado, and I suspect many Republicans around the country feel the same way.
You know, and a lot of the criticism, too, is an opportunity for some some people to get out there and get some attention for themselves. I mean, you've got the National Republican Committeeman from New Hampshire, and each state has one committeeman and one committee woman. And the National Committee Man from New Hampshire just decided to up and say, I'm resigning from the Republican National Committee over all of this. But, of course, it also turns out that he's running or
for
thinking
Congress.
About running
right.
for Congress. Well, this is a way for him to step out and differentiate himself and get some attention. And a lot of the time when we have these kinds of internal controversies in either party, anybody's apparatus, it's of far greater interest to people inside the professional class of people who do politics for a living than it is for voters in November. So I think you're probably right. This might not have any implications for November at all.
And it's funny, when you think of some great Republican national chairman in the past who have made a difference, these are people nobody's ever heard of.
Ray Bliss.
Ray Bliss is the name that comes to mind.
And today he's an institute in Ohio.
As he should be. Who rescued the Republican Party after the Goldwater debacle of 64. He's a mild-mannered, nuts-and-bolts guy from Ohio, and he helped the Republicans come back after 64. And he was so well-regarded that Richard Nixon, the first thing he did when he was elected president, was he dubbed Ray Bliss as Republican National Chairman. But that's the problem. When you're the party out of power, which is the Republican Party, they don't have national figures. I mean, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are not the leaders of the party, although they are the congressional wing. And so a lot of people look to perhaps maybe the chairman, like they did Haley Barbour in 93.
Haley Barbour was another very strong chairman.
Very effective
Highly
chairman
effective
and
chairman.
Did not embarrass the party. But anyway, so the Republicans have a chance to talk about this weekend in New Orleans.
Yes, where they're holding a gathering known as the Southern Republican Leadership Conference. And guess who's going to be there? Two or three people who might kind of like to think about being the nominee of the Republican Party for president in 2012.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about, but I understand Sarah Palin may be there.
Yes, Sarah Palin, well-known media figure, and perhaps in some people's minds the new conservative Oprah Winfrey, is going
She's
to be there.
She's also temporarily governor of Alaska.
She will be there. She will surely be the headliner. Everyone will be there to see Sarah.
That's Friday.
Except those who were there to see Tim Pawlenty.
Well, Tim Pawlenty won't be there. He'll be sending a video.
But what about Mitt Romney? We've talked a lot about Mitt Romney over the years. Can you talk a little bit about Mitt Romney?
I can, but I cannot do it in the conversation regarding New Orleans because he will not be there.
Well, now, wait a minute. We've said Sarah Palin is going, but Sarah Palin is widely thought to be an iffy candidate. Everybody thinks Tim Pawlenty is running. Everybody thinks Mitt is running. Why are they not in New Orleans? I put it to you, Ken.
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that Ron Paul will also be there. And Ron Paul, who won the CPAC straw poll, they're going to probably have a straw poll this weekend in New Orleans as well. And I suspect Ron Paul could win that too. Maybe Mitt Romney is just tired of seeing Ron Paul win these straw polls.
Is it because they're having a straw poll that some of these other candidates are staying away?
I don't know, but who are some of the other candidates? Actually, we've almost mentioned the whole list. Other would-be presidential candidates who are going to be in New Orleans. I mean, Bobby Jindal, of course, being the governor of Louisiana.
He'll be there.
And Haley Barbour, who's the chairman of the Republican Governors Conference, will be there.
And he lives next door in Mississippi.
Exactly. He'll be there. Well, but I'm not convinced that Jindal or Barbour or Mike Pence of Indiana, who probably won't be there. But
Jim DeMint.
I'm really not convinced that the Republican field for 2012 is going to be as large as the number of candidates they've been throwing out there.
What about Marco Rubio from Florida? Will he be there?
No, but he looks like he's doing very well. First of all, he got the key endorsement of Rudy Giuliani for Senate against
the Florida juggernaut.
He ran for president of Florida in 2008.
And was defeated, actually.
He was defeated despite Ron Elving's best interest.
I thought Rudy looked very tough in Florida after having skipped all the previous events.
Well, you were
much tougher than in New Hampshire where he didn't compete.
Well, you were boosting both Rudy and Fred Thompson, if I recall.
I was a big Fred Thompson believer up until when he decided to run.
But the last endorsement I could think of with Rudy Giuliani was when he endorsed Mario Cuomo over George Pataki. So I'm not sure if a Rudy Giuliani endorsement, if I'm trying to show my conservative bona fides.
But aren't we getting a little ahead of ourselves by talking about Marco Rubio being one of the presidential hopefuls showing up in New Orleans to be on the promenade and to walk the walk and try to get attention for himself in 2012?
Well, Jim,
I mean, he hasn't even been elected to the Senate yet.
True, and he hasn't even won the Republican primary battle yet, but there may not be a Republican primary battle because there is still speculation in the state of Florida that Charlie Crist, the once slam dunk nominee for the Senate, may drop out of the Republican primary and run as an independent. I don't think it'll happen, but there is speculation that it could, and the decision has to be made by the end of this month.
So we'll be mentioning that again next week in the podcast and probably the week after that. One other thing I think we need to mention about Southern Republican leadership, and that would be quite close to Washington, D.C., the new governor of Virginia, kind of stepped in it this week.
The question that I'm left with is, what in the world was Bob McDonald thinking? Why did he feel now is the time to bring back Confederate History Month? Now, I know, read the calendar why, because it's April, and there are a lot of famous Civil War.
And it's 150th anniversary next year. And he wanted to get it out there to talk about tourism, to bring a lot of people to the state, especially people who still look back fondly on the Stars and Bars and think that maybe we were better off in 1860.
To me, what's most troubling about this whole thing with Bob McDonald is not so much that he brought back Confederate History Month, which is still controversial, of course, but the fact is, the last time it was in the state of Virginia, Jim Gilmore, the Republican governor, added anti-slavery language to the proclamation.
Not a bad idea.
No. And yet, Bob McDonald decided, in his infinite wisdom, to remove that. Now, of course, when the Democrats took over in 2001, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, the Confederate History Month was gone completely.
Right.
When Bob McDonald brought it back, he not only brought it back, but he removed the language that Jim Gilmore put in about
slavery. Now, that sounds very active when you say removed. The governor has since apologized and said it was an omission.
Well, it was an omission because he got hell from everybody, including the Richmond Times leader, which strongly backed him. It's a conservative newspaper.
A very conservative newspaper.
And Doug Wilder, first African-American governor of Virginia.
And a Democrat.
And a Democrat whose neutrality in the 2009 governor's race
helped McDonald.
Absolutely. Yes, right. So you deal. Think that while Douglas Wilder had some nice thoughts and things to say about McDonald, he certainly didn't regarding this language. And Wilder went ballistic this week by saying that this is just unconscionable and how can you do this? And I think McDonald realized that he was getting battered from both sides, his right-wing allies and the people on the left who looked at him somewhat fondly. So he had no choice but to backtrack.
While we've brought up the name from yesteryear of Doug Wilder, I think we have to bring up a couple of others real quickly. Bob Ehrlich, former governor of Maryland.
Right. He's running again for governorship. He was defeated 4 years ago by Martin O'Malley. He is one of five former governors looking for a comeback this year. Roy Barnes of Georgia, John Kitzhaber of Oregon, Jerry Brown in California, and Terry Branstad in Iowa. So this is maybe the year of the comeback kids in the race for governor.
And another former governor, Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin, is taking a look at running for the Senate against Russ Feingold.
I'm not convinced he runs or not, but there was a poll released this week that had him a dozen points over Russ Feingold. Again, polls in April do not portend what's going to happen in November, but it certainly seemed encouraging if Thompson wanted to run.
Next week, we're going to talk about openings in the House, special elections coming up for the House of Representatives, but that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Don't call it a comeback.